This is Chapter a Day. I'm Norman Gilliland, reading again from The King of Confidence. It's nonfiction by Miles Harvey, published by Little Brown in 2019. And it tells the story of James Strang, who convinces a group of Mormons in the late 1840s that he is the successor to the slain Joseph Smith. And he brings that group first to a place in southeastern Wisconsin, Voree, as it was called, and then moves them to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan, where things are not entirely smooth, even after he declares himself king of the island. Several of his lieutenants are disaffected and leave the island, and some of them harbor grudges, as we find out. Now it's 1851, and Strang has been hauled into federal court in Detroit for a variety of crimes, including counterfeiting and also harvesting timber, federal timber, illegally. Chapter 13. Strang's trial arrived at a moment in history when tens of thousands of Americans, many of them educated and wealthy, had suddenly come to believe in unseen worlds beyond the scope of scientific understanding. The past 3 years, for example, had witnessed the rise of a wildly popular new movement called spiritualism, which traced its roots to a series of uncanny events at a farmhouse in the famous burned-over district of New York State, about 10 miles from where Joseph Smith had founded Mormonism. There in 1848, the Fox sisters, 11-year-old Kate and 14-year-old Margaret, proclaimed they had made contact with a ghost who used knocking sounds to communicate from beyond. The older sister, Leah, soon declared that she, too, had the gift, and in short order, 400 people crowded into the largest hall in Rochester to hear the mysterious noises and witness the sisters in conversation with departed souls. Since then, the movement had gained adherents with blinding speed. The list of true believers included many prominent Americans, business and religious leaders, journalists, judges, physicians, and scholars. Just 3 years after the Fox sisters had held their first seance, there were now an estimated 100 spirit mediums in New York City alone. If ever the world was afflicted with arrogant humbugs of any age, it is the present, declared a frustrated writer for Scientific American. The furious emergence of spiritualism coincided with another phenomenon that seemed to offer evidence of a country losing its grip on rational thought and action. Since the late 1840s, murder rates had exploded across the nation, according to historian Randolph Roth, who notes that some parts of the country that had been previously among the least homicidal places in the Western world suddenly became the most homicidal. For years, worried observers of American culture had noted a growing disposition to the wild and furious passions of savage mobs, as Abraham Lincoln put it in 1837. And by mid-century, superstition, alienation, and bloodlust seemed to be prevailing over reason and the rule of law. Until his arrest, Dr. Hezekiah D. McCulloch had built a seemingly distinguished career, serving as an Army surgeon and later as the health officer for the city of Baltimore. Nonetheless, he had sometimes exhibited erratic, even violent behavior. In 1846, for example, McCulloch was convicted of assault and battery in his hometown and then fined $50 for punching a fellow physician whom he had accused of stealing one of his patients. He had also been in financial trouble, facing a pair of foreclosure suits in 1848 and 1849, not long before he moved his wife and sons, ages 5 and 6, to the Michigan wilderness. The McCulloughs might indeed have believed Strang to be a prophet, but desperation as much as faith may have motivated their decision to begin life anew. Dr. McCulloch, it seems, had a weakness for drink. One later account asserted that he had fled Baltimore because intemperate habits had brought him into disgrace. According to this version of events, Dr. McCulloch had taken refuge with the Beaver Island colony, where liquor was unknown, in order to protect himself from temptation. Whatever his personal demons, McCullough brought valuable expertise to the Great Lakes, where a deadly cholera epidemic was then raging. Indeed, his main responsibility as the health officer for the city of Baltimore had been to keep the citizenry safe from disease, no easy task in the 19th century. At one point, the city council had asked Dr. McCullough to determine whether the pigs that roamed freely through town feeding on the garbage left behind by human beings should be excluded from the streets, as in some northern cities. McCullough responded that the animals were indeed offensive and unsightly and had vicious habits, but until a better system for taking care of the city's mess was put in place, the swine must be esteemed as useful. Strang appears to have taken a similar attitude toward the doctor, ignoring any of the newcomer's faults because of his proficiency and intelligence. George Adams, Strang's disaffected second-in-command, had been deeply resentful of the erudite newcomer, whom he considered mean, and once the tragedian was out of the picture, it didn't take long for the doctor to become one of the king's closest advisors. In addition to being the only physician on the island and the co-owner of a local store with a near monopoly on Mormon business, McCullough assumed a preeminent position in the church, according to the Northern Islander. But the combative physician also became enmeshed in the escalating animosity between Mormons and local fishermen, a feud that for the first time had turned deadly. In American Homicide, Roth attributes the sharp spike in murder rates during the late 1840s and 1850s to the fact that Americans could no longer coalesce. Disillusioned by the course the nation was taking, people felt increasingly alienated from both their government and their neighbors. This pervasive sense of estrangement provided the psychological subtext for the killing that took place at Beaver Island on June 7, 1851. Members of Strang's church, who had journeyed to this far corner of the world to isolate themselves from American society and government, now accounted for the vast majority of the island's population. The influx of these newcomers in ever-burgeoning numbers had meant that other residents, especially the local fishermen, felt more and more marginalized. No longer welcome in the town of St. James on the north end of the island, many of the fishermen settled in and around Cable Bay near its southern tip. A large number of these fishermen had been born in Ireland, early arrivals in the great wave of immigration that would bring more than 1.5 million survivors of the Irish potato famine to America from 1845 to 1855. Beaver Island, in short, had already become the scene of a heated turf war between two groups alienated from and persecuted by the culture at large. Caught between them was a third marginalized group, the local Native Americans. Having fled Beaver Island when Strang established his colony there, a number of them now lived on Garden Island, a couple of miles north of the Mormon kingdom. And by 1851, the Ojibwe and Odawa residents of this neighboring island had sided with the prophet's adversaries. The fishermen complained that Strang and his followers were stealing their property, harming their business, pressuring them to obey the laws of the kingdom rather than those of the United States, and forcing them to pay tithes to the church. Perhaps the prophet's most outspoken enemy among these malcontents was a man named Thomas Bennett, who, as the Northern Islander asserted in April of 1851, had vowed to have the life of Mr. Strang before another harvest. Strang reportedly returned this threat, telling Bennett that if he did not pay taxes in the form of tithes, mark my words that you will be sorry. Apparently he wasn't bluffing. Another witness later testified, McCullough had declared, that Bennett was the cause of much of the disturbance at Beaver Island and that they were bound to get him out of the way. A few days after allegedly uttering those words, McCullough joined about three dozen members of a posse that surrounded the house where Bennett resided at the south end of the island. The mob had come to arrest Bennett and his brother Samuel, who owned the house, for an earlier incident in which they'd supposedly threatened the life of a Mormon constable. But upon seeing the armed intruders approach, the brothers slammed the front door and, as Samuel Bennett later testified, told them we would not obey Mormon law, King Strang's law, or any other law, but the laws of our country. In the coming weeks, the two sides would tell sharply divergent stories about what happened next. The Mormons claimed that someone inside the house fired three shots at them, grazing one man in the head. Samuel Bennett, meanwhile, insisted that only one shot was fired, by accident, when his wife tried to wrest the gun away from him, and that it could not have hit anyone. The only points both sides agreed upon were that the members of the posse then rushed the house, firing through the windows and the door, and that when the onslaught was over, Thomas Bennett lay dead. A few days later, the Detroit Advertiser ran this headline: "Further outrages at Beaver Island. Brutal and deliberate murder by the followers of Strang." By that time, Dr. McCullough, along with several other Strang associates, had been arrested for the killing. It wasn't just the doctor's role in the fatal attack, however, that had suddenly made him notorious. With newspapers all over the United States, and even as far away as England, republishing the Advertiser's sensationalistic accounts of the murder, what really enraged critics were McCullough's alleged actions right afterward, when, as the island's lone physician, he performed an autopsy on the body. The Advertiser accused McCullough of butchery, claiming that after removing the dead man's heart, he had held it aloft and twirled it around on his finger. Blood was then scooped from the cavity of the chest from where the heart was taken, the paper claimed, and by the same hand was dashed with bitter derision on the face of the corpse. McCullough denied those charges, which his wife, in an open letter published in papers across the country, dismissed as slanderous reports which have emanated from a few perjured men. But the macabre accusations, coming less than 2 weeks before the start of Strang's trial, only added to the widespread perception that the prophet wielded such sinister influence over his followers that they were capable of any crime. In the depositions collected by the prosecutor, Bates, on Beaver Island in preparation for the trial, Strang's disciples regularly described him as a prophet gifted by divine inspiration and clothed with miraculous powers, as the Advertiser put it. But miraculous or not, those powers no longer held one key member of the colony in thrall. Amid the chaos of the prophet's arrest and extradition in Detroit, Mary Strang, his wife of 15 years, packed up her bags and left the island in May of 1851, taking with her the couple's three children. The exact circumstances of her departure, including whether it was voluntary or forced, are lost to time, but Strang's correspondence indicates that the prophet had exiled her from the kingdom. It may be that he had simply come to believe Mary was jeopardizing his hold on his followers, as one biographer put it. But there is another possible explanation, one more ominous and more in keeping with the homicidal mood of mid-century America. The lone clue for this scenario, a cryptic notation scribbled in the margin of a Strang family scrapbook, would not be discovered until a researcher happened upon it more than a century and a half later. The handwriting of the notation matched that of Charles James Strang, born the month before Mary's leave-taking. Mary tried to kill the writer of this when he was an infant. On the same day, the Advertiser ran that screaming headline about the brutal and deliberate murder by the followers of Strang. The prophet, who was still awaiting trial in Detroit, sat down to scratch out a letter to the governor of Michigan, John S. Berry. "I write you under the most painful apprehensions." Things had never looked worse for Strang. Not only did he face the possibility of years in prison, but his name had been ridiculed and reviled in newspapers across the country. His closest aides had been arrested for murder, and his lawful wife had left him. Strang implored the governor to protect the little settlement of Mormons on Beaver Island from a set of lawless renegades on the borders who have defied the administration of law there. Without intervention, he feared, the colony would be annihilated. Governor Barry placed the letter in his under advisement box. Although the exact sequence of events is somewhat ambiguous, it appears that on July 8, 1851, the first anniversary of his coronation as king, Strang stood before a jury to make closing arguments at his own federal crime trial in Detroit. Members of that jury had just heard several days of testimony against Strang and 12 co-defendants for obstructing the U.S. mail and assaulting a postal carrier with dangerous weapons. The prosecution's first set of charges. Star witness George J. Adams described how by the fall of 1850, the prophet had become obsessed with keeping critics on the island from communicating with the outside world. Strang, the tragedian testified, had vowed that once winter came and ship traffic ceased, he would have control of the mail and that communication should not leave there unless he knew what those communications were and from where they went. Adams added that he had once asked Strang how he planned to stop the wintertime postal carriers who took mail to and from the island once a month by dog sled. The prophet, he said, had replied that dead men told no tales, and that it would be very easy to cut a hole in the ice in order to dispose of a corpse. Other witnesses recounted an ambush on the frozen lake in which a dozen Mormons had tried to intercept a dog sled carrying the mail to Mackinac. The attempted theft had failed, thanks to the intervention of Indians from nearby Garden Island, who headed off the posse and hid the mail in one of their homes. The evidence was quite clear against them, Bates would later say about Strang and his co-defendants. From day one, the odds seemed against them as well. Only two members of the jury were Democrats, Strang's party, while 10 were Whigs, the party of Bates and the Detroit Advertiser. Now Strang began to address those men, staring them down with his intense brown eyes. The transcript does not survive, but other accounts of his verbal fireworks allow us to imagine what members of the jury might have experienced. In a different setting, one observer described that the prophet's oratorical skills were of the fervid, impassioned sort that would carry his audience with him every time. His words came out in a torrent. He could work himself into emotional spells at will, the sincerity of his words being attested by tears when necessary to produce the effect, or by infectious laughter when his mood was merry. He had what is known as magnetism. Even Bates came away impressed with the prophet's performance that day. Strang's speech to the jury was very strong, full of bitterness and dramatic points, he would later remember. He compared himself to Christ, his prosecutors to the lawyers and Pharisees who persecuted him. It took only a few minutes for the jurors to return with a verdict: acquittal of all 13 defendants. Bates, who had sunk enormous amounts of time and tax dollars into the arrest and unsuccessful prosecution of Strang, blamed his failure on the notion that the jury seemed to have imbibed the idea that these men were on trial for religion's sake. He faulted the judge, a Democrat, for steering jurors in that direction. But the prosecutor conceded that the prophet's speech had also played an important role. In Bates' version of events, jurors were just the latest victims of Strang's spellbinding powers. The Detroit Free Press, however, offered a very different view of the proceedings. Skeptical of the case from the start, the paper placed the blame for the verdict on Bates, who had badgered witness after witness about what the Free Press called the question of King Strang's gifts prophetical, rather than about any actual violations of the law. Whatever his motivation, the district attorney's decision to start the case with sensational charges of obstructing the U.S. mail would prove a fatal miscalculation. 2 months after the verdict, prosecutors in Detroit quietly dropped all remaining federal charges against the Mormons. Of the alleged crimes that had prompted the USS Michigan's spectacular raid on Beaver Island, including counterfeiting, not a single one resulted in conviction. And despite repeated attempts by Strang's enemies to apprehend Dr. McCullough and others accused in the murder of Thomas Bennett, none of the men charged in that case were ever brought to trial. It appeared that the cloud of suspicion that had hung over Beaver Island like a dense fog was finally beginning to lift. But then, less than 2 weeks after those charges were dropped in Detroit, 4 men invaded a home in Koshkonong, Wisconsin, a town about 60 miles west of Milwaukee, where Strang had a group of about 20 local disciples. On October 10, 1851, around midnight, a husband and wife awoke to find the assailants in their room. While one of the ruffians stood over the bed with a cocked pistol, a local newspaper reported, the other 3 proceeded to rob the house. Although the gunmen got away with only $11 in cash and some of the family's possessions, the incident outraged the surrounding community, which raised a posse of about 100 citizens. Eventually, 10 or 12 suspects were rounded up, all Mormons. The proof against these men, reported another local newspaper, is of the very strongest character. The whole Mormon community at Beaver Island are implicated in crimes sufficiently numerous and black to send them to the penitentiary. One of those arrested was an island resident named David Heath, a true believer who saw non-Mormons as the enemy. In a letter sent from Cleveland shortly after Strang's federal trial in Detroit, Heath had expressed joy at the prophet's acquittal. "I heard that you was to be hanged by the neck until dead, dead, dead," he told Strang, boasting he had known from the start that the prophet's enemies would not hurt a hair on your head. Yet for all his bravado, Heath could not disguise his concern that he had fallen from the king's good graces, having quietly fled the island during the tumultuous weeks leading up to Strang's arrest. It's not clear if this is a reference to a planned robbery, but there can be little doubt that he was involved in the raid on that home in Wisconsin 3 months later. In November of 1851, Heath and another Mormon man were found guilty and sentenced to 4 years in state prison. Around that same time, someone wrote anonymously to one of the papers covering the case in Wisconsin to report that on Beaver Island, the Mormons are continually going and coming, and their business is stealing, which they call consecrating. The correspondent added that the thieves generally go in bands, furnished with all kinds of burglary tools and keys and so on, prepared for anything that may occur, and armed to the teeth with revolvers, dirks, swords, and that kind of thing. The letter appears to have been written by one of Strang's fiercest opponents on the island, a man named Airy J. Moore, who had testified against the prophet at his recent federal trial in Detroit and had plenty of reason to cast Strang in the worst possible light. Nonetheless, the most startling allegation his letter contained would turn out to be true. The king, he said, had left Beaver Island on a secret mission in search of another place of refuge for his people. The prophet's plan, according to the letter, was to establish a new hideout north of the border from which he and his band of pirates could launch raids on targets in Michigan and Wisconsin, then retreat with impunity into Canada, and there laugh at those in chase of them. Strang's own correspondence makes clear that this was the exact scheme he had in mind. In late October of 1851, he penned his brother David a letter from Detour Township on the eastern tip of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, a couple of miles from the Canadian border, where he had been on an exploring expedition. He and his colleagues, James wrote, were looking to purchase a large island of the British and see if we cannot obtain the liberty of conscience in that empire which is denied us in our own country. The two siblings do not appear to have been close, and David Strang, a plain-spoken farmer who had remained in western New York, seems to have been singularly unimpressed by his brother's grand ambitions. "I fear," he had told Strang years earlier, "you are unsteady-minded." Nonetheless, the prophet apparently viewed his brother as a kind of confessor, someone to whom he could air his grievances, gloat over his triumphs, or offer justification for his actions. This letter found Strang feeling particularly sorry for himself. During their journey to the wilderness, he wrote, he and his fellow travelers had suffered through freezing temperatures, fierce winds, and almost constant rain and sleet. Not only was he short on provisions, but he'd also had a severe attack of inflammatory rheumatism, which had caused him to seek shelter at what passed for a hospital in this tiny village. During the wait, his mood had darkened. "Truly, David, this is a hard life I live," wrote the prophet, who could not see how things would change for the better. Although he had struggled manfully against his enemies, triumphing in federal court, he lived in constant fear of being arrested once more and sent to prison and to death. Adding to his anxieties, he confided, was the fact that Mary and their three children had left Beaver Island, though he didn't acknowledge having exiled her himself. "So many hopes have failed me that I work on mechanically. My heart is crushed and settled in melancholy, and it's stealing over me." He wrote that, adding that the one sole question is, shall I ever have one friend true and unchanging? Not even the compassion he imagined eliciting from his brother could heal my sorrow. "No, no, you have never lived in the wild scenes that have given their peculiar tempest to my feelings," he wrote. The King of Earth and Heaven felt entirely alone. "The snow is flying, and the ground is nearly covered," he added. Winter had descended early. We've been reading from the book, The King of Confidence, nonfiction by Miles Harvey, published in 2019 by Little Brown, and we'll read from it again next time. I'm Norman Gilliland, and this is Chapter a Day.